my number one piece would be to fully make sure you understand your needs and wants on your cancer journey. Make sure you understand what your treatment plan looks like and understand how you're going to truly make that work within your life. So I call it getting crystal clear on your needs, wants, and desires. And if you can't write that down, you're never going to be able to ask for help. Mm. Or if you ask for help, someone might bring you over a casserole that you can't eat because you have a dietary restriction. Mm. So it's getting really clear on many different facets. It's treatment, it's childcare, it's, you know, home care. Get it all outlined so you can accept that help.
Welcome to the Mama Shrink Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Cynthia Hauver, licensed psychologist, certified coach, and Gen X mama of two amazing boys. My belief, you can't be an awesome mama unless you're taking care of yourself first. And that's exactly why I created Mama Shrink. You'll get my 20 plus years of experience combined with some very real life struggles. And together we'll unpack the mental health, the physical health, even spiritual health to get you loving your mama life again. Listen, these kids of ours, they're only young once, and it goes by so fast, and you're never, ever gonna get this time back. We must learn to enjoy this wild ride of parenting. So if you're up for it, mama, let's do this. Hey, mamas, before we jump into today's episode, I just want to remind you that although I am a licensed psychologist, I'm not serving here as your psychologist. This podcast is not a substitute for direct mental health care. If you're struggling with a mental health issue of any kind, please reach out to a licensed professional. You can also contact the National Suicide Crisis Line by calling or texting 988. There's no shame in having a mental health issue, and it should always be taken seriously. Welcome back, mamas, to another episode of Mama Shrink. I'm your host, Dr. Cynthia Hauver, and today I'm so excited because I have my friend, Krista Tyler, who's going to be my guest, who is also a cancer coach, and she's going to talk with you about her journey through her own breast cancer and being a mom. And I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode today. Krista is a certified health coach, a cancer coach, and she has a background in nutrition. And she also created a home healthcare company that she manages on the side, which she doesn't give herself enough credit for. And Krista and I met through a mastermind this year with the beautiful Chris Carr, who is our chief unicorn. And we live close by, which the universe aligns in beautiful ways. So welcome to the show, Krista.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So we're recording this in my dining room. And so if you hear any background noises or perhaps some leaves going or the dog, that might happen. But we're going to try and keep it as quiet as possible. So, Krista, I was reading through your story, and I think I'll give you all the links after the show to go to KristaTyler.com so you can get all of her wonderful information. But I wanted to start by asking if you could share how old you were when you first got diagnosed with cancer and what that was like for you when you first discovered an abnormality on your breast, and just walk people through that journey.
Sure. So I was 28. I had two little kids at the time. My son was about 3.5 years old, and my daughter was about 7.5. And I was busy. I had life going on. And one Saturday morning, my kids magically did not wake me up at 6 a.m. And I was laying in bed, and I was like, oh, I should feel my boob. It's October, right? So we feel our boobs in October.
Yeah.
And I found a little area that wasn't a lump, but it was more of a thickening in my skin. I was like, well, that's kind of weird. And I went back to it and I said, oh, it's still there 20 minutes later. Shocking.
And I watched it for the month. I said, maybe it just has something to do with my period. And maybe it's just, you know, a cyst, and just sort of pushed it from my mind, as moms do. Mm. You know, we never take care of ourselves to the same way that we take care of our kids. So November came and it was still there. So I booked an appointment and I went in and I saw my gynecologist, who said, oh, yeah, it's probably nothing. Oh, yeah. But you know what? Let's just image it to be safe. I said, okay, cool. Mm. So at this point, I was irritated because I had taken time off from work to be there. I had to switch carpool with another mom, which, you know, of course, type A mom irritated me.
Yes.
And I went and I did all the things and I pushed it from my mind. And then I got a call back and they're like, hey, we want to do some further imaging and we'd like to do it at a different center that does just breast imaging. And at that point, you sort of pump the brakes and you're like, oh, mm-hmm. oh, wait, is there actually something alarming? Right. This isn't just like my kid kicked me in my boob. Like I thought it was when right. I was like, you know, football carrying him out of a birthday party a month prior.
Yeah.
So it was, I was coming from a place of irritation.
Yeah.
Because my flow was messed up as a mom. A friend of mine that I knew from our school that our kids went to, she had breast cancer and I had mentioned it to her in passing. And she's like, oh, you should go to the breast center that I went to. Did not take her advice. And I ended up going to the local breast center that was close. It was convenient and I could get it done before my kids got home from school and before their next activity. At that center, they imaged it again and they said, oh, it's suspect. Let's, you know, watch it for a few months. And immediately in my brain, I said, it's suspect, but let's watch it. Mm. And alarm bells sort of sounded. And I called my girlfriend and I said, okay, so what is your thought on watching it? She's like, no. Absolutely. Oh, thank God. So I ended up taking her advice the second time around and I did go to a proper breast center and that's all they did was breast disease.
Yes.
And it was a big difference. So they brought me in, they re-imaged, they did a biopsy and they said, we'll call you in about a week.
Oh my goodness.
From there. So of course, now you're in the waiting game. And about a week later, I still hadn't heard back. So I called the doctor's office and said, hey, you know, I haven't heard back. I was just wondering what was going on. And at that point, I was sort of on the bandwagon. No news is good news. Mm. So she goes, oh, yeah, sure. Let me just put you on hold for 1 second. And I remember it clear as day. I was sitting in the study in my house and sunlight was streaming in and it was just a beautiful day. And she pops back on the phone. She's like, oh, no one called you? We had to send that out to a tumor board. So
what?
Yeah. Like, boom, by the way, I was like, whoa, what does that mean? And she goes, well, that it's, you know, needed some other eyes on it so we can make a proper diagnosis. But your surgeon's not here today. So I really can't give you any more information. And she'll call you when she gets back in the office on Monday. This was a Thursday.
Oh my God.
Yes. So I remember feeling like everything was crashing down around me and my whole world had just sort of been deconstructed in that flippant statement. Yes. Of we need more information to get a clear diagnosis.
And leave you for 5 days wondering.
Right. So that was a fun weekend, as you can imagine.
Right.
So that moment was the moment in which, when I reflect back, that I felt the most devastated right there in my study, my cat flipping around.
And you remember that image in your mind.
And I remember it. And when I close my eyes and go back there, I still remember those feelings. Mm-hmm. I remember pacing around the upstairs of my house, losing my shit completely, knowing I had to get on a conference call in like 15 minutes for work. And I think as a mom at that moment, I somewhere in my mind made this decision that, okay, I can do this, whatever this looks like, I can work and I can still be a mom, right?
Oh,
I can just do it all.
Yeah.
No
just
problem.
Fit it right in. Fit cancer right
just
in.
Fit it right in between, you know, your lunch break and your conference call.
Yes.
And I didn't realize at the time that that choice to be this super mom, if you will, really shaped how I approached everything moving forward. Mm. So yeah, it was an inconvenience and I was just going to fit it in.
And did you go to your meeting in 15 minutes after you found that out?
I did. And I got on a conference call. And I am quite sure the other people on that call wondered what I was talking about, if I was even present
in parts of the meeting.
And yeah, I did. I don't remember the subject of that meeting. I do remember certain things being on my wall that I was like, oh yeah, I have to scrub that off.
Mm.
My kids, I think, wrote. And those were those weird things that I focused on to just still my mind at that point.
Yes. And so you were 28 at the time.
28.
And were you thinking, this can't possibly be because I'm so young?
So yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone's like, oh, you're so young. It's no big deal. Mm. You are so young. So these are the statements that we heard for years, but you're so young.
Yes.
I found this, but you're so young. So it did bring me a little bit of solace. But on the flip side, conversely with that, is there was a family friend that was diagnosed with breast cancer in her 30s.
Yeah.
And this other mom that I just spoke of, she was only a few years older than me, and she was diagnosed when she was 32.
Right.
So all of a sudden, there's people that I know in my real world that had a breast lump, and even though they were so young, still had breast cancer.
Yes.
And that shifting that dynamic and that awareness that just because you're young, that's not safe. Just because you're menopausal, that doesn't make you immune.
Yeah.
So if you are walking around as a person,
yes,
you have a risk.
Yes. And, you know, the fact that you are a very knowledgeable, smart woman, and it was Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and you checked your breasts, and you saw something, but you thought, as a busy mom will, I'll get to that. And, you know, and you waited till November, really, like, because you thought, no, it's no big deal. It's probably just, which I think most women do. And so would you recommend, like, if you find something on your breast, get it checked as soon as possible?
If you find something, note where it is, note how it feels, and call your provider, call your doctor and say, hey, I just found this. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And a lot of times they'll say, hey, make an appointment. They'll ask you maybe about where you are in your menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. And so many times it is a benign nothing, but just have that awareness. And if you bring it to your physician's attention and you are not being taken seriously because you're, quote, so young, mm-hmm. find a new doctor.
Yes.
Find someone who's going to listen and take you seriously.
Yes. Amen. And so what happened next? So on Monday?
So it was probably Monday. Everything that whole weekend was a blur. I'm sure I did some horrific parenting that weekend. And Monday they came and they said, yes, there's a small area of focal DCIS with atypical ductal hyperplasia throughout the breast. I was like, okay, what does that mean? And unable to really digest what was being spewed out to me, I latched on to her saying lumpectomy, tamoxifen, and then the next words were quick recovery.
Oh.
So whatever she had just said, I heard quick recovery and I said, sign me up.
Okay. Okay.
So that was it. Quick recovery. I needed to be back in top fighting form for my kids.
Mm-mm.
So that's what I did. I had a lumpectomy. I did go into it apparently still very concerned about how long it would take, because as I was being wheeled into the OR, I asked the anesthesiologist, how long will this take?
Which and, I love, by the way.
Yes. And his response, which I'll never forget, is this is not a 30-minute photo lab. We will be here as long as we need to be. And then he gave me something in my IV. And I didn't care how long it took.
Yes.
So that was my lumpectomy.
And then when you woke up, what were you told?
When I woke up, I had searing pain in my shoulder. So that, I don't remember anything about what my surgeon said. I was more concerned about this discomfort that I was feeling. That was, no matter what they gave me, I still felt it. And it was a searing nerve pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I just remember wanting to get back home to the kids. I wanted to just put this experience behind me and move forward.
And what were, did you tell your kids at this point yet, anything?
So we had told my kids before I had my lumpectomy.
Okay.
So that was the hardest conversation that I have ever had in my entire life and will consistently be the hardest conversation. We had to keep it age appropriate.
Yes.
And my daughter, though she was 7.5, is a super bright kid. And she was not taking things at face value.
Oh.
And we did work with a child psychologist, thank goodness that we had one that we could quickly consult. And they said, use simple language, talk about it from a cellular level. So I think the language that we used, and you know, everyone, every situation is different, your kids' ages, but we said that there were some bad cells in my breast that we needed to remove so I could continue to be, you know, perfectly healthy.
My son, and at that time, you did not know what else was in store. So you were just telling him
That was it. It was, you know, you're going to have a lumpectomy. It's an outpatient procedure. You go home the same day and then you start tamoxifen and you're on that for 5 years. And that's what the protocol was at that time. So my daughter was skeptical. She didn't take it quite as easily as my 3.5-year-old son, who was like, okay, mom, can we have popcorn tonight? Yes, my love, we can have popcorn tonight. So we took it at face value and my daughter was skeptical. So that was, I think, my misstep number one with introducing it to my kids. And then my misstep number two is I never took advantage of all of the wonderful services available that breast centers offer. Family counseling, art therapy for your kids.
They do.
A lot of places
I don't remember ever learning about this, but that's good to know.
Yeah, some of them do. I don't know that all. But, you know, some centers have really phenomenal programs, music therapy. And if you're going to be given a shitty diagnosis and you're a mom, take care of those kiddos. All of these services that are available to you, eat them up. Use them and take them.
And did you seek out a therapist for yourself?
Later I did.
Oh.
And I met with her, you know, probably 3 or 4 times at the most. And that's my other takeaway, that that should have been a long-term commitment. And then over the years, on and off, as things would pop up as a result of this unresolved trauma that I had, I would go back into therapy.
And the only reason I ask is because moms are so like, oh, the art therapy, the music, all the stuff at the cancer center for the kids, right? And it's like our first thought is always like, what can we do to make this okay for our kids? But, you know, you're going through the diagnosis. You're dealing with all that. And it wasn't like, I need to talk to someone right now.
So the number one thing that you can do to take care of your kids is take care of yourself.
Yes.
Use all of those programs that we just rattled off. Take care of yourself to take care of your kids.
Yeah. So important. And so when did you find out this was more? So was that what you did from that point on was, okay, I had the lumpectomy. I'm taking tamoxifen.
Yeah. So we started the tamoxifen and that was smooth sailing for, you know, 72 hours. But yeah, so that was the plan, tamoxifen with monitoring on a very regular basis every 6 months. If there's anything that crops up in between, we'll take it as it comes. And that was sort of the plan of action. About a year into that, you know, said course of action, I had a mammogram and they found a whole focal area of my other breast with hyperplasia, ductal hyperplasias, and an area that they wanted to specifically pinpoint and watch. Throughout this, I was doing genetic testing. Everything was coming back negative. So there was really, you know, was this just bad luck? Was this environmental? No one could really. And of course, I wanted to know why. Why?
And did anyone in your family have breast cancer?
My grandmother.
Okay.
As when she was older.
Okay.
She wasn't young. And that was it. She also had uterine cancer. But everyone was happy to dismiss that because she was in her 70s at the time. So after pushing it a little bit more with genetic testing, they finally identified that I did have a genetic variant that puts me at a higher risk for breast cancer, as well as colorectal cancer. So that made sense in my brain.
Yes.
So it was a CHEK2 variant. And when my first round of genetic testing, it wasn't identified and tested for.
And how, why not? Do you know?
It just wasn't identified as a sequence to be looking for at that point.
So interesting. So how, why did they think to then do that test?
Because it was a new test that became available
as
the time has sort of worn on. And I'm sure like everything else, and as technology emerges and changes, there will be other genetic screenings that become available.
So would you suggest that moms have that, specifically ask for that test?
I think that's in the hands of your physician.
Okay.
But
the genetic testing that they do at cancer centers at this point, and even just a regular oncologist office, it's much broader than it was, you know, and we're going back to 2011, 2012 for 2023.
Yes.
So we've had, you know, over a decade of that time to develop genetic testing. So I do believe it is a part of just a regular routine panel of genetic testing. It just wasn't at that time that I, you know, was
diagnosed. Gotcha. Okay. And so then you're taking tamoxifen, they find the other
side. Because of the genetic variant, it all sort of fell into place. I decided to not be in this constant state of, when is the other shoe going to drop? When is this area, and it was like most of one side of my breast, going to become a problem?
Yeah.
So after a lot of thought and vacillation and back and forth and insurance rigmaroles, I decided to have a bilateral mastectomy.
Wow.
With a direct-to-implant reconstruction.
Was that encouraged?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was. And the first surgeon that I went with, my insurance approved, but didn't approve at the hospital that he wanted to operate at. And I got really discouraged. And I pulled the plug. I said, we're not going to do it. I'm just done. And I didn't go forward.
Okay.
And we tabled it for about 6 months. And in that time, I was like, you know what? I'm anxious and it doesn't feel right to me. This is what feels right to me. It feels that I am being proactive. It works for my life.
Gotcha.
So I ended up going through with the surgery in 2012. And the mastectomy went well. And the plastic surgeon after the mastectomy part of the operation came in and did a direct implant reconstruction. So I went into surgery with breasts and I came out with reconstructed mounds, breast mounds.
Okay.
And in my brain at that point, that was okay.
Okay.
Waking up with breasts would be okay. So I remember waking up, I looked at the clock and I couldn't understand how it was like 1 a.m. So it turned out to be a much longer surgery than, you know, originally we thought it would be. I was told that my breast flaps were very thin, but it was fine. We used, you know, ADM, an atypical dermal matrix, I believe, acellular dermal matrix to help that area not be so thin. And
what does that mean in lay terms? Like stretching your skin?
Basically like cadaver skin that they take and they can use to put over the implant to help cover it.
Oh, okay.
And it, you know, absorbs and grows into your own. Fine. Great. I woke up the next morning and the nurse came in to do chest checks to make sure everything's looking good. And when she opened my hospital gown, she's like, oh, it's okay. Let me, you know, note that. I said, well, what? And there was a small area that was a little bluish, a little purpley. And she said, don't worry about it. We're just going to keep an eye on that. And as the day progressed and more checks went on and my surgeon came in, he said there's an area that he is worried about the blood flow in and that he was concerned about potentially that skin dying in that area.
Oh, gosh.
He said it doesn't happen very often. And of course, this was a risk they went over, but they gloss right over it.
Yes.
And they make it sound like it's like 0.5% of people, which it's actually not.
It's not.
It's actually a significant percentage of people.
Wow.
The last time I really researched it, I think it's anywhere between 20 and 30% of
that. That's
men.
High.
It's a high percentage.
Yes.
Don't quote me directly on that.
Yeah.
But it's a high percentage, much greater than, you know, not having, if you just had a mastectomy, adding that implant really ups the risk of it. So long story condensed, that area of skin that they were worried was going to die, died. So about 1.5 weeks after my mastectomy, I went back into the operating room for them to remove that area of skin and close back over the implant.
Yikes.
And that they were able to do. But it didn't work. So I had two other surgeries after that, still in the vein of trying to save the implant and save that, you know, breast flap.
Mm.
And everything sort of seemed stable after the third surgery.
So what were you telling your kids during all this? Is mom's going back in and having a surgery and another surgery and another surgery?
Not enough.
Okay.
We weren't telling the kids enough. And that was my big aha moment 10 years out.
Well, hindsight's 2020.
Right. So we said that you know, part of the skin is not healthy and it's not surviving and we just have to just remove it. But again, it was totally downplayed as they were so little at the time.
Yeah.
And we, in the moment, it felt okay.
Okay.
It felt okay for that moment. And I wished that I had sought out the child psychologist and immediately put my kids in therapy.
Yeah.
Just even if it says, you know, someone to talk to. So we didn't, yes. You know, so that was a misstep on my part.
But I'm also thinking in that moment, you were dealing with your own back-to-back appointments and in crisis mode of what is going on with my own body. You're not really thinking like, how do I line therapy up for my child? You know, exactly. I mean, that's just not how people are thinking at that point.
Yeah. That's the reality of it.
Yeah.
So fast forward, it was somewhere around Father's Day weekend. I was finally feeling pretty good. I still had open sores on my chest and did wound care several times a day. And it was gnarly to look at, which I did my best to avoid really looking at it, changing the bandages. But I finally started feeling good, which was amazing. And I was super excited for the weekend. And we were out on the lake and it was a late afternoon. And I remember saying, I'm a little cold. And it was a beautiful day out, but there was a slight breeze.
Mm.
So I was like, I'll just put my blanket on and get cozy. And I progressively felt colder. So I remember saying, I think I'm just going to go home. Do you want to stay with the kids, to my husband? And you can bring them home whenever you want. I'm just going to go home and like take a shower and just warm up.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, sure. So I got home and I looked in the mirror and I noticed that my whole right side was completely fire engine red on my breast.
Wow.
So that I knew was a huge issue. So I...
And it wasn't a sunburn.
It was not a one-sided sunburn.
Yeah.
It was not.
Yeah.
And I was cold. So I took my temperature and I had, you know, a 101 temp.
Oh.
So I called my surgeon and I remember him sighing on the phone and saying, okay, I'll meet you in the emergency room.
Wow.
You should come in. And my husband was at home because he was still at the lake with the kids. And I called and I said, hey, so I have this weird red patch and I have a fever. And I spoke to my surgeon and he said that I should come into the emergency department to be checked out. And he's going to meet me there.
Mm.
And I said, I'll just go by myself, like bring the kids home, do their baths, feed them dinner.
This is why Krista and I are friends, because we just think we can do everything by ourselves.
Right. So just you take care of the kids.
When you're dying of a fever and you're going to drive yourself to the hospital.
Like 45 minutes away.
Yep.
I drove myself. I parked, I came in, I was like, hi, I'm here. I think I have an infection. Okay, show me your infection. Pull up my shirt. Oh, come with us immediately.
Oh, wow.
So as soon as I got there, I guess maybe it was just sort of, I don't know, adrenaline from speaking with my surgeon, sort of being nervous. Everything just kept on progressing. But the second they got me in a bed and I sat down, I remember realizing how exhausted I was and how hard it was for me to keep my eyes open. Mm. And I was just so tired, which again, I was like, yeah, busy day. And the nursing staff came in and they were amazing and they were drawing blood and there was a whole frenzy of people. And they asked me who my surgeon was. And I told them and he said, he's on his way. And they were taking vials of blood into these. In my memory of it was like a Frankensteinish looking glass jars.
Mm.
And it felt like there was so much blood. And I turned to the nurse doing it. I said, am I going to lose my breast implant? And she looked at me and said, that's the least of your worries. You were most likely septic.
Oh my God.
Infection. And we're just going to try to stabilize you.
And that was the first time anyone had said, like, this is really serious.
Yeah. Because they just whisked me in. Nobody really said a whole lot of anything. I guess I should have put the pieces together when my surgeon, who apparently was at his weekend house an hour and a half away, was willing to drive back to see me and now starting to hear all of these pieces. So I was admitted. I was indeed septic.
Oh my gosh.
Had a massive infection. They started me on massive IV antibiotics. And at some point, either that night or the next morning, it all blended together. They made the determination that they had to take my breast implant out because indeed it was harboring a huge amount of bacteria and just a horrible infection there, and it needed to be cleaned out. But they decided to do so because of how, you know, poorly I was doing at the point, not to do it under general anesthesia.
Yes.
So I was awake
Oh my gosh.
It was numb. From, okay. I have no feeling really from my clavicle, my collarbones down to my upper ribs.
Okay.
But you know, you're completely aware of what was going on.
Oh my God. And you could hear them all and all the stuff.
You can see it and hear it. And they punctured the breast implant and drained it. And it's, you know, water that you feel. And it was, that was traumatic.
Yes. Yes.
So I spent about a week in the hospital on massive IV therapy. And initially it wasn't working. They changed it. They found the correct, you know, formula to get me, you know, feeling better and get the infection under control. And I was finally discharged home to continue with outpatient IV therapy twice a day.
Wow. Did they think you were in the clear at that point? Or was it still like we have to watch and wait?
Yeah, they felt pretty confident that it was going to trend in the right direction. Once they got me on the right medications, they said there was a pretty significant change in my blood work to make them feel that I was okay to be sent home.
Okay.
But indeed needed to continue with that IV therapy twice a week.
And so, during that time, when you're in the hospital and you're septic and all of that was going on, did your kids know what was happening then?
I didn't want to see my kids.
Oh.
I remember clearly saying to my husband, tell the kids whatever you think is appropriate, but don't bring them here.
You didn't want them to see you like that.
I did not. Yeah. I had a gaping hole on my chest.
Yeah.
Packed with all sorts of disgusting gauze and bloodied and and I looked like hell.
Yeah.
And I just remember wanting my kids not to have that vision of me.
Yes. Which is so not like such an like selfless thing to do, right? Because like some parents might be like, I have to see my kids, but you were like, no, I'm thinking of them.
Yes.
So I don't want them to see this.
And that is what my takeaway was.
Yeah.
Now, fast forward this 10 years, both of my kids independently said, the one thing I wished you had done differently was for when you were in the hospital for us to see you.
Oh, so that's not how they took it.
So that's not how they took it.
Yeah.
And in their little kid heads, they spun the worst case scenario.
Yes.
The worst case scenario.
Yeah. So what did your husband tell them?
I still don't fully know.
Oh, God.
If we're being really honest.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't really know exactly the language that he used.
Okay.
But he said, Mom has an infection and she's in the hospital.
Okay.
He works in the medical field. Yeah. He's a physical therapist. He does home care. He sees a lot of things. So he's definitely toughened and hardened to it. So there's a 98% chance that he talked to them like they were little colleagues.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Well, and he's a dad. I mean, and, they're not the same as moms and giving information.
Exactly.
So now they look back and they say, because this is important, I think, of the message trying to get across to moms is sometimes we're doing things thinking we're helping our kids, but in hindsight, you know, we always can learn from what they share. And I think it's knowing maybe that's a conversation I needed to have with them.
100%.
You know, do you want to see mommy? I am really sick. I don't want to scare you, but what would that be like for you to come and see me?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then the next misstep is when I came home, I was exhausted. All I wanted to do was sleep. I was recovering from a massive infection. I had no energy and I couldn't lay flat after my mastectomy and all of, so I had drains coming out of me. So I had an armchair in our master bedroom and I slept in that, that damn thing for a very long time.
Mm.
But the kids, my husband said, let mommy sleep. Like, just let mommy sleep.
Yeah.
So my son at this time, who was, you know, probably about 4.5 or 5 at this. He was just turning 5 because I had to cancel his birthday party, actually. He would peer through my door when I was sleeping.
Oh.
He would open it just a crack and he would see me and he thought I was dead.
Oh, gosh.
Which, of course, we didn't know this at
the
time. But that's what my little guy did. And he was peering through at what he thought was his mom that was just being held in this room, but was gone.
Oh.
So that was therapy.
Yes. Yes.
And we started seeing, you know, we called it the mama locator.
Oh.
Wherever my son was, he screamed for me, Mom, I need you. And I would, you know, go to wherever my little guy was. What's up? Nothing. Forget it. Never mind.
Oh.
Yeah. And this would go on about every 7 minutes.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So that landed him in some quick therapy.
Okay. But that's what was the catalyst.
And that's what the catalyst was. Yes. And after a year of therapy, he never verbalized this to the therapist, but he came home one day after baseball and was like, "Do you know why I did the Mama Locator?"
Oh.
I was like, "No. Why?" He goes, "Because I thought you were dead."
Oh.
And so I had to know where you were, so I knew you were fine.
Oh my gosh. And what was that like for you to hear that?
Well, broke every piece of my heart. And I just scooped him up and did not want to let go of this little guy.
Mm.
So yeah, talk to your kids. Keep the lines of communication open.
Yeah.
And even when you are acting in their best interest, have the conversation.
Yeah. It's so hard. It's so hard. I think, you know, and sometimes I get flack from my kids because I tell them too much, because I think as a therapist, I'm always like, okay, so your mom found out that she has this issue and this is what's going to happen. But because I have also learned in my own work with people of things they, you know, we learn from, that's why we're sharing this, right? Because we want other people to learn from the things we didn't do. And I think it's easy to say when you look back.
Yes. So if there's anything shared on my journey, is keep the lines of communication open.
Yeah.
And keep them open all the time. Not just when you're first diagnosed, not when you first have a surgery, not when you first start treatment, but keep them open through the entire process.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been my findings that once I open those lines of communication up with my kids later than I should have, I will say that. But they've stayed open.
That's
into
great.
Into teenagerhood.
Yes.
Like the stuff that is shared with me with my kids as a result of laying that groundwork.
Love it.
Is amazing. There are times that my son will say things, and there are times that my daughter has shared things while I was driving a car at 65 miles an hour on a highway that I almost drove off the road were so shocking.
Yes.
And I just remember riding the vehicle, taking a deep breath and saying, thank you for sharing and being so amazed that, you know, that
beautiful.
Groundwork has stayed open. And to this point, you know, my daughter is 20 and my son is 16.
Yes.
And they're still sharing wild things with me.
Which is great.
Journeys, and it's the best thing ever. So
And Krista is like, her kids are, I met her son, but she has great kids. And, you know, and I think the important thing is if you're listening to this and you have done maybe not some of the best talking to your kids during a diagnosis like this, you can always go back and fix it. Like, that's what I, you know, like, I mean, it's showing your kids I care enough to still work on this. And you did that.
Yeah. Last night, when I was prepping to be here, I was just going over my day with my son of what that was going to look like for both of us and how our routines would be a slightly changed. And we talked about it all.
Oh.
And he had some great insights and, you know, and I asked him, I said, what was your number one thing that I should have done differently?
Oh, I love that.
And I also asked my daughter this.
Yeah.
And their answers were very similar. You should have included us more.
Wow. Wow. That's what they both said.
Yeah. Slightly different language from them.
Yes.
From my son, who's you know, a 16-year-old boy versus a 20-year-old, very cerebral girl.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is you should have included us more.
Wow. Yes. And how was that for you?
It was heartwarming and heartbreaking to hear, but I also did the best that I could as a mom at that in that moment and in that season. And it allowed me the time with them to lay the groundwork and to have the relationship where they can now tell me that this is where you could have improved upon.
Yeah.
So if there's nothing else taken from this conversation today,
yes. And I think that's so important. And, you know, and I think, you know, also taking kids with a grain of salt, because sometimes they can be, you know, like very hard on us, especially when you're trying to be the good parent and you're still getting flack, because you had shared with me that your oldest daughter said that one of the things that bothers her about you is that you're so competent, right? Is that what she said?
Yeah.
So it's like even things that we think we're doing right as moms, like we're fixing the stuff, we're protecting them from seeing you in that state.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, sometimes you can't win.
Sometimes you can't win. Sometimes it's setting the bar really high that as kids get older, they're like, holy shit, is that really where the bar is?
Yeah.
So I think it all comes together.
So what happened with, because I know you had a really intense experience taking the tamoxifen. And I think it's so important that women who have any type of breast cancer, because it's usually the number one drug that's told to women to take, that there are some pretty intense side effects and you have to weigh them carefully. And we're not anti-tamoxifen. It's just saying a lot of times it's just given to women, and Krista and I are both in the healthcare field, and even both of us having experience with tamoxifen, a lot of women don't even understand what it can do. So I think you have a lot of knowledge on that.
So that being said, a lot of women are premenopausal when they're diagnosed with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So as far as my knowledge goes, there's really only one drug of choice, and it's tamoxifen.
Yes.
So it's widely prescribed, and it is spun as like, hey, it's just a pill you take once a day. No big deal.
Yep.
But it does come with a whole host of side effects. Brain fog, moodiness.
Blood clots. I remember I went on my own to go get tested to see if I was at risk. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a whole, so there's a lot going on with it. I did choose to take tamoxifen. Mm-hmm. I did take it for 5.5 years. Mm-hmm. My husband's nickname for me during that time pretty much sums it all up. He labeled me the Tamoxa bitch. And he was 100% correct. 100% correct.
But it makes you feel that way.
It made me feel crazy. Mm-hmm. I would have massive mood swings. I would have outbursts. Something small would happen. I don't know. I would drop a vase of flowers. No big deal. Normally you just clean it up and move on. That was a huge event in my world. Mm. So yeah, hot flashes, night sweats, mood swings. Nobody wants to talk about the sexual health side effects.
Yes.
Where you go from being a young woman with a great sex life to all of a sudden having a vagina of a 70-year-old, 80-year-old. No one talked to me about that.
Yeah.
And it was only through a few conversations with other younger women that we were all like, oh, so we're not just fucked up. It's everyone.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so there were so many. I mean, I could go on and on with the side effects that I experienced.
And why were you told you had to take the tamoxifen?
An insurance policy. It'll help, you know, at that point, I had both breasts when I was first put on it.
Yeah.
And then when my other breast had areas of concern, I hadn't been on it for very long. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, well, if I was on the tamoxifen, would this have happened?
Oh, gotcha.
And there was it's hard to say. We don't know.
Yes.
So there was that level of like, hey, if this could prevent something from, you know, growing, forming. I have two little kids. This is my insurance policy for them.
Yes.
And every day when I would swallow my medication, I remember thinking to myself, this is my insurance policy for my kids.
Yes.
And I did it. And I did it for 5 years.
Of course you did.
And just as you got to the 5-year mark, they're like, oh, hey, exciting news. Now we take tamoxifen for 10 years. And I remember feeling so defeated because I had just gotten to that.
And you were looking forward to that 5-year mark.
Oh, hell yes. I was looking forward to that milestone. And I endured it for a little bit longer after that 5-year mark. And I finally said, I am insane. I am depressed. Mm-hmm. I feel like my body is not my own. Mm-hmm. And what version of my kids, what version of myself do I want to give to my kids?
Yeah.
Because this sure as hell, not the version I ever signed up to give my little loves.
Yes.
So.
And you were, and they were at those crucial ages during all this, right? Because they were so young when you had the cancer diagnosis, and then all those 5 years of being on tamoxifen.
Yeah. So like they had a crazy tamoxibitch. And I remember writing it in my journal. I was like, my husband called me the Tamoxa bitch, but he's not wrong.
That has to be a blog post right there. Yes, I love it.
Yes, it will be. And I didn't want to be the Tamoxa bitch mom.
Yeah.
So I got really serious about my personal wellness. Mm-hmm. And I sat my husband down and I said, you know, this was with the guidance of one of my dear friends who had a firsthand view into this miserable version of me.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want to take this anymore. And I don't know how to tell my husband.
Oh, okay.
And they're like, just like that. Just like that. Just say that.
Yeah.
And that conversation will start.
Yeah.
So I sat him down. I was like, I don't want to be on tamoxifen anymore. And the look of relief that washed over this poor man.
Really?
I was okay. Like, oh.
Oh.
He's like, you are fucking miserable.
So he's been like, holding that in for 5 years?
Yeah. So, I mean, God bless him. But yes.
And people are probably afraid to tell you that because they know you're taking a medicine that's going to keep you alive. So no one wants to tell you you're being a bitch.
Right. So you're taking this medicine for your family.
Yeah.
To help, you know, keep anything from forming.
Yes.
So now what are they going to say? Hey, you should stop that because you're such a bitch.
Yeah. Right.
No one's going to say
that. And your kids have to choose between a tamoxifen bitch mother or a mom who's alive.
Right.
Not great choices.
I made the decision that we would up my screening. We would do a slightly different surveillance. Mm-hmm. I was getting ultrasounds a little bit more frequently, breast MRIs at that point as well. So we just sort of rotated up how we were doing that. And that, for me at that point, felt good.
Mm.
That felt good. It felt like it was balanced. And I got really serious with my diet. I cleaned up my diet. I never had a poor diet.
Yes.
But it wasn't what it is now.
Yeah.
And the deeper I got into a sound diet for me and the trickle-down effect with my kids, mm-hmm. the better I was feeling.
Okay.
I started running. I was introduced mm-hmm. to running, which I never ran as a mm-hmm. kid. I sucked. And that was an amazing cathartic activity for me.
Okay.
Got me in great shape, kept me, my mind strong.
Mm-hmm.
So that is still something that is every mm-hmm. day. Yoga, meditations, I was doing it all.
Yes.
And over the years, I've sort of honed it down to my small little morning routine.
Mm-hmm.
And I am feeling the best version of myself that mm-hmm. I have.
And you've been cancer-free for how long?
Oh, that's a good question. About 8 years.
Okay. And off tamoxifen for how long?
Oh, God.
So 3?
No, longer than that. So, I mean, because we're going back to 2012. So I've been off of it for probably 6-7 okay. years at this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then what made you pivot? Because you are a board certified
health coach.
Yeah. And you're running this, you know, open this amazing home healthcare business, doing all the things. And then you decided, I'm going to switch.
So one of the evenings that I was solo in the hospital in the middle of the night, not sleeping during my, you know, massive infection, I was like, this is the worst fucking journey ever. Mm-hmm. Is this really what it has to be?
Mm.
And I was just desperate. And I was just, you know, thinking of how could I have made this better? What could I have done differently? Mm-hmm. And at that point, I was probably trying to lay blame on myself. What did I do to get this infection?
Yes.
Did I go out on the boat and got lake water in it? Like,
oh so my goodness, I'm doing yes, all the things. Yes.
But the root of this internal dialogue was, how can I share my experience so other women don't face this?
Mm-hmm.
And there I was with all my little IVs coming out of my arms and my chest.
Mm.
And I said, I want to share my journey and I want to make it so other women don't face this at some point.
That's beautiful.
At some point in my life.
And that's the stuff that I think sometimes gets you through it, you know, where you're like, okay, what am I learning? Like, there has to be a lesson in all this. Why am I hooked up to all these tubes? Why is this happening? And saying like, I'm going to help other people.
Yeah. So it was my own little idea that I did not share with anybody. I did not share with my best friend. I did not journal about it. I didn't tell my husband. And slowly and quietly over the years, as I was working and being a busy mom and doing all of the family obligations, I became a health coach. And then I went back and became board certified and I got a further degree in nutrition. And this at that point was all under the guise of like, how can I help other women? But how can I also continue to support myself?
Oh, okay.
And that was I always was fascinated by nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to clean my health up, my diet up a little bit further.
Yeah.
My son had always had GI issues that later turns out he's celiac disease. So it all came together for me. And as after, you know, right after the pandemic, really, I was like, I really need a change.
Mm-hmm.
I need a change.
Yeah.
And this is what I want to do.
That calling? Because I think during the pandemic, like so many of us changed, and it was like, was that your moment of like, oh yeah, I'm doing something different in my life.
So I was quietly going back to school and doing all the things. The pandemic definitely, you know, fueled that fire because we had all this extra time that we were at home. We weren't going out. We weren't doing things. And there was just so much upset and turmoil that I think, you know, created a lot of internal reflection. And I, you know, was coming up on my 40th birthday and I said, is this really what I want to do forever? I said, no. 10 years ago, I said, I wanted to help other women face their cancer and wellness journeys.
Yes.
I had no idea how to do it. And slowly, little by little, I've been piecing it together. And the one thing that I had solidified was the program. How to get women through this journey.
Yeah. Oh, so you already had the program in your head.
I had it in my head. Yeah. I had it on like those post-it notes.
Yes.
Like, you know, the ruled, the slightly larger post-it notes. Yes. In, you know, in my journal, in my office drawers.
And what were like things you were putting on those post-it notes?
One of like the topics was rest and digest and, you know, what to do when you first figure out that you got some shit to deal with. What should you have done? And I basically wrote it as what I wish I had had at that point.
Yes.
And it's evolved and it has changed dramatically over the last decade. And I've had the privilege of working with a bunch of women and seeing what their needs were and seeing what their feedback was and just being able to tweak and tailor. But that's the basis of it, is how to move through your cancer journey. And not just survive it, but truly thrive on the other side of it.
And do you feel like now you're at the point where you're thriving?
I do. I do. I wake up in the morning and I have a really wonderful, you know, I'm not a morning person, so I'm always a little crumpy, but it's like I have my routine figured out. This is the best that I have felt in over a decade. And I get to be here sharing my story. I get this time with my kids and getting to see them and my husband and our whole world together. So I do. I do feel like I finally have come into my own to thrive.
Yeah. And Krista is now offering coaching with women who have cancer. And I think one of the other things that also, besides all your life experience, your certifications and all of that, you also have a very smart, keen sense of open, you know, starting your own home healthcare business. So one of the things that's so hard to navigate that you also help people with is talking to their insurance companies and the providers and advocating for yourself.
Yes.
And I think, you know, Krista offers that where you can't get that from a lot of people because people aren't going to tell you that.
Yeah. So that was born out of dire necessity. Yes, we worked in healthcare with a home care physical therapy practice, but we had really shitty insurance. And, you know, what did I know? We had, you know, I just, oh, it's fine. It's
When you're 28, you're not really checking your health insurance.
I was like, oh, that's good. We have all our preventatives. Perfect. So I learned really quickly, and at least I was in that world enough to understand how to navigate it. But I have seriously honed that. And it is such, even though it is a miserable thing to navigate, you have to do it. And you have to be able to do it in a cohesive manner that gets you the results that you need.
But I think that's a beautiful piece of, you know, if you, and I will put all the links up to work with Krista, and where can they find you?
So I'm on Instagram at Krista Tyler Coaching, or you can also head over to my website, which is Krista-Tyler.com.
And how do you spell Krista? Because people are going to spell it with a K.
It is C-H-R-I-S-T-A-T-Y-L-E-R.
Perfect. Yes. And when you work with Krista, like you will get, you know, the whole thing. It's like she's been through the journey. She wants to help other women and can navigate this crazy insurance nightmare when you're dealing with a diagnosis no one wants to deal with. And you've also had the experience of having kids yourself. And if you're a mom out there who's gotten a diagnosis of cancer, it's so scary. And knowing you don't have to do it alone, and there are resources out there that aren't maybe the typical things you would think of, and reaching out for that.
Yeah, that's as a mom dealing with a diagnosis, make yourself the number one priority at that point on your journey so you can continue to give to your kids.
Yes. If there was like one thing you could offer moms who might just have gotten a cancer diagnosis, what would you say?
My number one piece would be to fully make sure you understand your needs and wants on your cancer journey. Make sure you understand what your treatment plan looks like and understand how you're going to truly make that work within your life. So I call it getting crystal clear on your needs, wants, and desires. And if you can't write that down, you're never going to be able to ask for help. Mm. Or if you ask for help, someone might bring you over a casserole that you can't eat because you have a dietary restriction. Mm. So it's getting really clear on many different facets. It's treatment, it's childcare, it's, you know, home care. Get it all outlined.
Yeah.
So you can accept that help.
Great. Thank you. Well, this has been so much fun, and thank you for sharing your story.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Wasn't Krista amazing? Please follow Krista. You can find out all about her. She is able to currently work with you if you are in need of a breast cancer coach to get you through your journey. If you've been recently diagnosed or have been struggling for a while, she's phenomenal. And I'm blessed to call her a friend. So head on over to her website at Krista with a C dash Tyler.com, and it will be in the show notes in case you're listening and aren't able to write it down. Until next week, mamas, keep on taking care of yourselves. Bye. Thank you so much for listening, mamas. I really value your time. And if you like this episode, please share it with a friend and leave a review, because they always help. If you want to learn more about me, just head on over to my website at drcynthiah.com. And you can find me on the socials at dr.cynthiahover. Until next week, please keep on taking care of you, because life really is too short not to be happy.